I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. Peter Nowak joins me again. He's written an engaging new book, Humans 3.0, The Upgrading of the Species. Technology over the past decade and a half has ramped up to the point that we're seeing innovation on a daily basis thanks to it. So this not only affects how we live and how much longer we live, but it's affecting ourselves in a way we may not have thought of heretofore. Throughout Mr. Nowak's book, we get instances of how what it means to be human is changing. I'll get him to tell us about some of the things, good and bad, that are affecting how we are as a species. Technology, Peter Nowak contends, that set us apart from our earliest selves is now becoming part of the evolutionary process. It'll be interesting to see what all this means for sustainability and livability on the planet. Peter Nowak is an award-winning journalist and the best-selling author of Sex, Bombs, and Burgers, How War, Porn, and Fast Food Created Technology as We Know It. He was on with that book in 2010. He's a syndicated blogger for Maclean's Canadian Business contributes regularly to the Globe and Mail, the Huffington Post, the CBC, and other sundry outlets. The website for more is wordsbynowak.com. The book is published by Goose Lane Editions. Please welcome back to the Plant Online program in Toronto today, Peter Nowak. Mr. Nowak, good morning.
Hi there, how are you?
Thanks. Pretty good. Yourself?
I'm not too bad.
So as I told you before we started, this is just an engaging book, and it had me hooked from the beginning. How did you come to the central theme of the book, that technology isn't as bad as we might have thought it was, and this idea that it's really changing who we are in our evolution as a species? Did you come to that conclusion and then decide to write the book, or did you find this out as you were writing it?
Yeah, actually, it's the second. It was a complete discovery on my part, too. In fact, the first draft of the book was kind of written in sort of almost like a travel log, a sort of road to discovery as I found these conclusions. Because I really came at it from, I think I'd like to think, a neutral perspective. I think when it comes to writing about technology, in the media, we see one of two extremes kind of happen. You have the specialized technology press, and I think, by and large, they're generally overwhelmingly positive in terms of how they write about technology. Then on the flip side, in the mainstream, which is really where I've worked for most of my career, I think you have the opposite. There tends to be almost a negative negative position taken towards technology. I think that's because the mainstream press, and I talk about this in the book, tends to focus more on the side effects of technology, and those I think are more short term, and they're always kind of new, and so I think that's why we tend to see a lot of them in the media. But you don't see a lot of coverage of the actual effects of technology, because those things are longer term and more subtle. So when I started working on this book, I came at it from a real neutral perspective to try to. I looked at the data, I looked at the numbers, and I tried to formulate my conclusions from those. And that's where I, just by looking at that data, I kind of ended up becoming somewhat optimistic, I guess.
Yeah. So where do you see humans having changed because of technology? I mean, where is that keenly realized?
I think probably the most noticeable change is we're becoming a lot more individualized. And I think we're probably more individualized now than at any point in history. And by that I mean you look at pretty much, I think that the way the book breaks down is that each chapter looks at different aspects of our, what it means to be human. So there's a chapter on the jobs we work, there's a chapter on the relationships we have, a chapter on our beliefs, and so on and so on. And in each of those, I kind of found that we're kind of breaking away from the large groups and kind of doing our own thing more and more. I think where it's most noticeable is in terms of expression and communications. So you look at things like just how much people are doing online, how many photos they're sharing, the blogs we're writing, music we're creating and sharing, and so on and so on. The Internet in particular has really given us the ability to express ourselves quite a bit. And some of that is not necessarily, anything that would be considered artistically good. If you put a photo of your ham sandwich on Instagram, that's not necessarily art, but it is expression. And so I think that coincides actually with some of the some of the other demographic statistics. One in particular that I found pretty interesting is the tendency to what's happening to senior citizens these days. Far more seniors are now ending up going to retirement homes than used to actually live with their families and their extended families just a few generations ago. And this is happening not just in Canada, it's happening basically around the world in any country that's advancing or that's economically developed. And so that's, you kind of have family sizes growing, you also have fewer people getting married, fewer people having children, so you have families are getting smaller, families are getting more insular, and we're also expressing ourselves quite a bit. I think you put those two things together, and I think you have an interesting trend going on.
This idea that we're identifying ourselves more, say, online, are you really saying that we didn't have an identity heretofore?
No, I don't think so. I just think that it's one of the other effects of this technology, and this goes back to economic prosperity, which I spend a good chunk of the early part of the book talking about. So what's happening here is you have, despite rising inequality, which I also talk about quite a bit, uh-huh. There's definitely rising inequality in a lot of advanced countries, but by and large, the world is becoming more prosperous, and developing countries are advancing as well. So when you have advancing prosperity, and that also translates into entrepreneurialism, too. In Canada, actually, we have a boom in entrepreneurialism. There's more people starting their own businesses than ever before. So what you have is you have a rise of individuality there as well, and that's economically driven. So you are essentially what we get into in the second half of the book is if we go back to high school sociology class, it's a little bit of Maslow's hierarchy of needs. So essentially what's happening is that more of our basic needs are being met. Those are being fulfilled. So we're rising up that pyramid to take care or to start worrying about, not worrying about, but start to fulfill some of those higher level needs, you know, the more ephemeral ones, which is, self-satisfaction and respect of your peers and all that kind of stuff. So I think we've definitely been individualized before, but I think we're now, that's probably the biggest effect of technology on a personal level, is it's allowing us to find out a little bit more about ourselves and to fulfill ourselves a little bit more.
And then if you notice that if you encounter someone who says, oh, I don't use Facebook, or I don't use or I don't tweet, or I don't have Instagram, we automatically make assumptions about who they are.
Mm-hmm.
And that's exactly. Something new, isn't it?
It is, and it's, it's kind of funny because a lot of those services are still pretty new, so I don't think we've quite figured out what their place is in the grand scheme of things. They could very well just be passing fads. I think a lot of people have suggested that in the past. The specific services themselves, Facebook, could be a passing fad, but it does. The idea of it is not, I don't think it really is. Facebook, I think the reason for its success is it's provided this this kind of internet of people you know. There's the larger internet, which is millions and millions of strangers out there. But the Facebook is basically like the internet of just those people that you've either are friends with or people that you've somehow encountered in your life. So I think there's definitely something there. How that translates into the long term, I'm not quite sure.
And do you have any evidence as to the quality of these relationships that are cultivated, say, through Facebook?
Yeah, and I think I talk a bit about that in the book, too. I can't remember the exact number, but I think it's something like 250. That's the average number of friends that and I use friends in quotation mm-hmm. marks. That the average person has on Facebook. Facebook itself has said that, the famous 6 degrees of separation theory, with or without Kevin Bacon,
yeah.
Facebook has said that that's declining thanks to its service. So now there's fewer jumps between, yourself and any other person in the world, because there are, there's fewer links you're bound to know
yeah.
somebody who knows somebody who knows somebody.
Mm-hmm.
The quality of that, again, there's some decent evidence that the overexposure of us, the overexposure that some of us are engaged in on the internet, there might actually be a reaction brewing to that. Some of the stats I found was that despite this rise in online, the whole online friends phenomenon, the number of actual close confidants that the average person has is shrinking. And I think that kind of makes sense, because when you go online and you're putting everything out there, including what you had for lunch or whatever, that's kind of your persona. That's your public persona. And who you really are, I don't think you necessarily share that with too many people. And I think that kind of makes sense as to why why we may have fewer and fewer actual close people that we relate to.
And then what do you make of, because we hear a lot about cyberbullying, trolling, online alienation, say. These are, I guess, all things that come with technology. Do you think we're overcoming these things, or do you think it'll get worse?
Yeah, I'm not sure. I don't really touch on the whole idea of cyberbullying too much in the book. I think it is, again, it's a relatively new phenomenon. Bullying is not, but of course, the ability to do that online is relatively new. I'm not quite sure how that's going to work itself out, to be honest with you. I think there's a real push towards actual real identities online. There's certainly there's an argument for that. Anybody who's done anything online, I write stories all the time and they get posted, and of course then you get attacked by anonymous commenters, and whenever that happens to you, you're like, we really need those real identities online. On the other hand, there are valid reasons for anonymity, and I guess, I don't know, I'm not quite sure how that's going to play itself out either. Trolling is something that's kind of been around in various forms since we've had media, so we're just in the latest evolution of it.
Yeah, I guess because we can do it anonymously, say. They think that, well, I mean, most people think that that's one of the I guess attendant realities of greater technology.
Yeah, and I think in that case there needs to be, I think one of the side effects of that is going to be, maybe not the side effects, but a good reaction to that will be an even stronger emphasis on, and this speaks to the internet in general, not just trolling, but also, there's been quite a few news stories lately about, fake stories online and why people believe them or how they don't even care if they're true or not. I think some of that is going to filter back into the education system. And while it's always been true that schools have always, their primary role has or should have been always to teach kids critical thinking abilities, I think that's going to be even truer now in this internet age. I think if anything, that should be their primary focus, is to teach people how to critically assess what they see online, both in terms of the news stories they read and in terms of the commentary that they're getting from anonymous sources. And that's something I think that's going to be increasingly important as we go.
What I found interesting in the book is the chapter on faith. And how technology has affected that. What's happening in Korea that you found was interesting about people and their relationship to spirituality, to faith, even religion, organized religion, if you will?
Yeah, well, that was actually one of the more interesting interviews I had while working on this book. I spoke to a South Korean monk in Seoul, and he was part of one of the older Buddhist orders there, and this order is notable because they actually co-design mobile apps for phones, and they do this because these apps are designed to help provide information about Buddhism and give anybody who's looking at these apps information about where they can go and which temples are open and so on and so on. And the monk was telling me that now South Korea, for anybody who doesn't know, is probably one of the most technologically advanced nations. They are. Their internet is incredibly fast, incredibly cheap. Same with their mobile phone networks. South Korea is also a powerhouse in robotics research. So South Korea, very advanced. So even the Buddhist monks there are, kind of hip to technology. And so his explanation of that was that religion is not necessarily, doesn't really stand in opposition to science and technology. In fact, it's kind of complementary. They're kind of complementary to each other. this particular order is designing these mobile apps because they do need to go where people are. So that's, you know, everybody in Korea obviously has smartphones, so that's where they need to be as well. So it's a pretty progressive idea. And on a deeper level, too, one thing he was saying was that technology doesn't necessarily provide the answers, and science, while it provides answers, it inevitably delivers more questions. So, and that's essentially the whole, what's really at the core of much religious belief is how do you answer those questions that can't, that seemingly can't be answered. So his thinking is that as long as science continues to deliver more questions, there will always be religion.
I touched on this in the introduction because this fascinates me, this idea of sustainability, because we hear whether, you know, our economies are sustainable enough because they keep growing and growing and growing. So in the realm of technology that you look at in this book, I mean, we all have drawers full of adapters and chargers that we'll never use again, for devices that you know that we have the same number of that we'll never use again. There's a statistic in the book, and I wish I pulled it out. Just the number of devices, the number of computers we have in the world today, as opposed to say 5-10 years ago. I'm assuming 5-10 years down the line we'll have more. So, in terms of whether that's sustainable and that's good for the planet, what conclusions have you come to in the course of writing this book on that?
Yeah, well, we talked about earlier about the difference between side effects and effects, and obviously I think global warming is one of the worst side effects we've had of all this technological advancement, and I think global warming is kind of can tie into all of that resource depletion and basically just any sort of environmental issues. Our environmental, the problems that we have today are a huge side effect of this technological advance. I'm optimistic about it because I kind of, again, I tried to approach this very, from a very data-oriented perspective, and that is, you know, I looked at previous situations where there have been some really bad side effects that we've come up with over the past couple of millennia, and this has led to a number of, you know, dire predictions. The most obvious one was the whole food shortage. The Reverend Thomas Malthus, several hundred years ago, looked at our population growth trends and said, well, the world can't possibly sustain all this. We're going to eventually run out of food, and then that's going to lead to massive war, massive pestilence, and all the four horsemen that you can think of. It never came to pass, of course, because what he didn't count on was the technological advance going into food production, and that actually developed faster and grew faster than the population did. That particular side of things, I think, there's predictions now where the world is going to need to increase its food production by about 70% by 2050 to meet population growth. That's something I'm not too concerned about because we do have technology is continuing to increase food production. And the population growth, meanwhile, if, again, there's numbers on this in the book, talking about birth rates and death rates, and population growth is actually going to predict it to level off this century. So it's entirely possible we're going to actually see food growth continue to outpace population growth. So ultimately, we might actually have more food than we know what to do with. That's a little bit of an optimistic prediction, but I think it's not entirely out of line to make. Now, in terms of other resources, in terms of global warming and climate change and that side of things, I'm kind of optimistic there, too. That one is a little bit, the numbers there are a little less convincing or a little less, they don't point in as clear a direction. But, again, that's where technology, there are unanticipated technologies coming in the future that I think are going to help us out in regards to you know, reversing or even perhaps repairing some of the damage we've done to the environment.
And so, do you have predictions as to say what will be the state of the world, say, 5 years from now? Even, I mean, I think I read this in your book that the iPad wasn't. I mean, the iPad is what, 5 years old now, or less than 5 years old?
Yeah, I think it was 2010. 2010 or 2011. I'm not quite,
yeah,
quite remember.
So, I mean, you know, that's just become a part of everyone's life now. What do you see in your crystal ball, if you will, as to what we'll be using or platforms, devices, software that we'll be using, say, 5 years down the line?
I think robots are the next big frontier. There's a number of smart people, including some of the big companies, car companies, believe that we're going to start seeing robot cars on the road. They're going to be relatively mainstream, or not mainstream, but they're going to be available for purchase, if you will, by 2020, which is just 5 years from now.
Huh.
It might even happen faster than that, because we are seeing some big news in this area. Google, of course, has been working on robot cars for some time. The big automakers are also working on them now. There's talk about Uber, that's it. Sorry,
yeah.
I was trying to think of what the company was called. Uber, which is, of course, the ride-sharing app. They've now opened a research center on robot cars in Pittsburgh. There's, of course, Apple. Talk about that. Apple's going to get into this. I'm not sure if that's true or not. But you are seeing incredibly a lot of interest in this field. And when you have a lot of interest, you're going to get competition. And with competition, things tend to move very quickly. Robot cars, I think, are really going to change. They're going to change everything. You just have to really let your imagination run loose on that. If you all of a sudden have cars that drive themselves, and you, we already have apps where you can actually just call up a car that will come pick you up. Of course, Uber.
Mm-hmm.
Combine those two, then you have you can basically punch in on your phone or whatever on your device, and you have a robot car come pick you up in 5 or 10 minutes. Once that starts to happen, then you kind of have to wonder, well, why would anybody want to own a car? I'm sure there's obviously cases for that, but in a lot of cases, I probably wouldn't want to own a car if I could just call one up in 5 or 10 minutes and go through the expense of having to actually pay insurance and all that. So I think you're going to see a lot with robots, particularly in cars. That's going to be a big change, I think. And other than that, I don't think too much is going to change over the next 5 years, and that's probably a good thing because we've had so much change over the last couple of decades. First with the internet, and then with the mobile internet, then you have the social media revolution and all this stuff. It's quite a bit to digest. So I think in the last few years we've had a little bit of a slow period, and I think that's been a good thing.
Well, what has happened historically to humans when we, say, get technology to do more of the laborious things in our life? You mentioned robots and robot cars and driving. I mean, if we get rid of that, say, from our you know, most of us get rid of it from our beings, if you will, what does that change in say, who we are?
That is, I think... not to sound too much like a Pollyanna, but I think with every previous step towards automation that we've taken over the course of history, it's been steadily upwards. So if you look at the jobs is probably the best example. The jobs we work at, the stat I tell everybody is, 200 years ago, more than 75% of North Americans were working on farms, whereas today it's only 1%. And those people could not possibly have imagined many of the jobs that are commonplace today. So, could a farmer in the 1900s have imagined web design or video game design as a job? Absolutely not. I don't think we can imagine. It's similar for us. I don't think we can possibly imagine what we're going to be doing 100 years from now or 200 years from now. What we've heard a lot about over the last year, especially the last year, but over the last couple of years, we hear this on a routine basis about how robots are taking so many of our human jobs. It's almost there's almost stories every day about what new jobs robots are going to make obsolete. And there's quite a bit of angst over that. What we haven't heard quite enough yet, though, is what kind of jobs are those robots going to enable? So if you think about going back to the robot cars example, once you have robot cars that are commonplace and relatively accessible to the average person, that's going to spawn numerous business opportunities. You can do all kinds of different delivery services. You can have, the average person might be able to start their own taxi service or something to that effect. You have to kind of let your imagination run wild there. The point is, though, is that we don't really know. We need to, and that's what I think we need to do a little bit more focusing on, is focusing not so much on what we're losing, but a little bit more on what we're going to be gaining.
See, I keep thinking of that. You saw that on the news, I'm sure. The robot sweeper that ate the lady's hair while she was napping. See, yeah. I worry about stuff like that, you know.
Yeah, that's definitely. There's always the Terminator syndrome, right?
Yeah.
That's perhaps a very mild form of it. When the robot eats the person's hair. I think more people are concerned about that robot becoming sentient than eating her hair on purpose. Yeah, with luck, there's the opposite side of that too, which is I read an article recently. It was by an IBM engineer, and I really liked what he had to say, which was that you hear a lot of doom and gloom from the likes of Bill Gates has said it, Stephen Hawking has said it, that they worry about artificial intelligence, kind of being the end of us. But what the IBM engineer suggested was that artificial intelligence is improving. Very quickly, but artificial intelligence consciousness is another matter entirely. For an actual computer to become conscious, we don't understand what makes us conscious yet, so we can't. I don't think we can possibly understand what makes a machine conscious or how to make a machine conscious. I think that's still a pretty far ways away. At least that's what some of these smart guys like the IBM engineer believe. So.
But don't you have someone in the book who said that it could be as soon as 2045?
Sort of. That's Ray Kurzweil. He's a pretty well-known futurist. His suggestion is that what's happening is that computers are, their ability to think is improving. It's doubling, actually, roughly about every 18 months. That's known as Moore's Law. And so his projections are that they will equal the human capability to think by 2045, and there's some dispute over whether that date is correct or not. But regardless of whether it is or not, that's really just the capacity to compute. That's when computers are going to have the equal computing capability of the human brain.
Mm-hmm.
It's still I make the distinction in the book between intelligence and wisdom. And the wisdom of computers is not growing nearly as fast as their actual intelligence. So whether they're going to be able to make their own decisions by 2045, that's probably not going to be the case.
Yeah, you just have to invent a computer that'll know how to apologize, and I think we're set, you know.
Exactly.
Pete, this is pardon me, I called you Pete because I'm used to hearing Nora Young call you Pete all the time on Spark. So,
yeah.
Pardon me, Peter, congratulations on this book. It's a hell of a read. Thanks for your time today. Continued good luck with it.
My pleasure.
The book is called Humans 3.0, The Upgrading of the Species. It's from Goose Lane Editions. Visit the website, too, wordsbynoak.com. The book's author, Peter Nowak, joined me on the line from Toronto and Vancouver. I'm Joseph Plantin.